for those who are listening in. So I will read my name as it appeared on the Farm Conference 88 Participant Directory, February 5 to 7, Santa Rosa, California. There was Herman L. A., Ambassador Foundation, and our address with a phone number. There were a number of other interesting individuals in attendance, some representing the government of California, some from areas far and wide. Sometimes you come up as a surprise in an occasion like this, and I would like to address the subject of agriculture and the laws of God pertaining to agriculture, business, property, because it's all woven together. One of the things that struck me, that's unusual, was the number of blacks in attendance. Now, I might have guessed Japanese. There were, I don't think, more than two or so Orientals. But this was not the ordinary money-making program. This was an actual study of the problems of agriculture, sustainable agriculture, organic agriculture, what is taught in schools. It was rather one of those unusual opportunities locally where we don't have to travel too far as we often have to Washington, D.C. or New York for certain things. But we met a number in the black community who are in business and in farming, the business being in connection with the distribution of food, for instance, in Compton. All I can say is this is the first time I have ever had this kind of experience, and I thought it was an unusual turnaround from the experience that many blacks remembered for several generations, the problem of working on the farm in some kind of servitude, and then to have been freed only to discover how do you buy land when you are a free slave with no money. But significant changes have taken place. In one of the dinners, when we tried to attend certain ones, you sometimes meet people in a social occasion that way you wouldn't think to. We sat down in an empty area in a logical place. On one side of the table were three blacks, and so three of us sat down on the other side. It was an opportunity to get acquainted. And they were all from Southern California. But a number from Northern California are in the farm business, and one man represents the presentation of such material in print and on radio for the state of California. Anyway, that was an opportunity to have a new perspective of the importance that many blacks are placing on the right direction in this particular area. I'd like to take a little time before we look into the biblical material to let you know what one learns from places like this. There was a beautiful large placard. I think my wife picked one up, but I didn't want to carry it here. It's something you couldn't put in a folder. By the American Cancer Society. Now, the plain truth, of course, the good news, our publications would have addressed these questions. In principle, in the 1950s, you know, when they all got started again, the growth of the college, Mr. Armstrong was addressing them in the 1930s and 40s as well. So what was remarkable about this American Cancer Society placard is that it shows you the food that you could eat, which offer, in a sense, defenses against cancer. Now, it doesn't say that it will prevent cancer or that if you have it, it will cure it. But these foods are those which are considered to be important in the defense mechanism of the body in its fight against cancer. And of all things, there were all the beautiful vegetables that you grow in the garden. And the suggestion was that you should see them that way rather than in Campbell's soup, if I may use a term as my own. In other words, it was seen in terms of what you get out of the garden as distinct from what you buy in a little can or a bottle on the store shelf. But it says, what are the cancer risks? And they point up the things we have already learned. Stop cigarette smoking, go easy on alcohol, have respect for the sun's rays, trim the fat from your diet. Moses had something to say about that. Use of nitrate-cured food. And then on another section, what are protective factors? And here it gives a list. So what was remarkable is, in fact, that we were addressing this kind of thing when people were paying no attention. We were addressing these questions 30 years ago, just out of the simple principle that this is the way God made the food in the first place. Now, that's a relatively simple deduction. It's essentially the same as why God's women don't have to wear makeup to look beautiful, but that's another topic. God made us with certain things that are the natural sources of beauty, the natural sources of health. Before the function of the meeting formally commenced, we had a chance Friday morning to take a tour. Normally, in a case like this, the assumption is that some people come in early and want to fill up their time, so they provide a tour. This, however, was one of those remarkable occasions. Not only did some people come early, but so many did that at the last minute, they had to arrange two tours. One was to a farm run by Mr. Bob Canard, of French descent, who teaches farming at the Santa Rosa Junior College, where he also manages the Santa Rosa Junior College Experimental Farm. On his farm, which you'll be seeing, he raises a large variety of organic vegetables, which he sells locally to restaurants. In this case, his primary market is a restaurant in Berkeley. This area was in Napa County, so the meeting was held, the meetings were held in Sonoma County, in the wine area of Northern California, for those of you who are familiar with it. This man was an unusual person to get to know. I had a chance to pick up the agribusiness program from the junior college. And I saw also the schedule of classes, and I was very pleased to see that in this junior college, they are in fact teaching. Thank you. They are in fact teaching the fundamental problems as at the University of California at Santa Cruz. I will interrupt. There is a vehicle with lights on and with a battery, we have presumed. The vehicle is a brown Toyota, license plate number 427UXG, underground parking lot. Brown Toyota, 427UXG. Feel free to get up, turn the lights off, and come back and pick up the story wherever we are. We won't wait. This man teaches farming, teaches business, and he teaches organic farming. This town of Santa Rosa happens to be one where I was born. It has a junior college that was there before there was any junior college in San Francisco. It happened to be, in years past, one of those areas in the state of California with, I would say, some of the highest educational standards in the state. I think that the standards are fairly high today. I have no reason not to think so. But it is interesting to see that in this junior college, about 60 miles as you would drive from San Francisco or Oakland around, it's in the range of 45 to 60 depending on your route, that they are indeed teaching some of the basic principles of organic farming, something that Mr. Armstrong was interested in. When Ambassador College was founded in 1947, and he used to look around, and he realized, though, that he simply couldn't put his time into that and everything else. And it was many years later that we were blessed with whatever opportunities have been afforded us on the Big Sandy campus. What was remarkable about Mr. Bob Kennard is something that we can all learn. He's a man who has to make a living. He's doing it partly by teaching and partly by working on the farm. And to make the farm go, he has a market. Now, one thing that I think is coming up in television, I just saw it today, and we'll look over the weekend and then have a chat about it, has to do with how to get your first job. It's an interesting topic. But it is also important to realize that getting a job presumes that somebody else created it. It is also vital to recognize that you don't always have to have somebody else create your job. Perhaps you can create your own. Now, it doesn't always start out that way. But I think it's important to realize that the farming business is essentially not just getting your first job, although you may have had many first jobs. This particular business, which today is only handled by about 3% of the country, 97% live in urban and suburban environments, this kind of job is essentially self-management and planning. And you learn a lot by watching men like this. This man has a restaurant. The restaurant uses his produce. Now, the important thing, if you're going to have a restaurant use your produce, you have to provide the food. The restaurant attracts the people. And if the restaurant that attracts the people has no food, 500 customers a day will not continue to come back to the restaurant. So this man has learned not only the importance of organic vegetation, vegetables, fruit, he's learned that it is important to design a farm such as his to provide the fundamental basics of vegetation and fruit that a restaurant will need that has as its fundamental approach organic food to serve the clientele. It's one of the basic principles that is slowly developing, one of the principles slowly developing in the state of California. It means if you were growing them according to the fundamental principles laid out by common sense in agricultural science, as well as an understanding of the way God designed the nature. The nature should be self-sustaining, not something where you ruin the soil and simply move on. Let me tell you a little bit about his farm. He's in a most unusual person. He's farming a slope. Not a true slope, but it does slope, and there are hills. It's undulating. Not really a hillside, but it is a hillside. It's one of those, you know, slowly moving down the hillside and moving up in a little other direction here and there. There was once a turkey ranch. And being a teacher, he chose this because this is the one place you would never plant fruit and vegetables. And he has chosen it to show what can be done. The soil is so fragile on this hillside that it doesn't deserve to be used this way under normal circumstances. It had been a turkey farm. The turkeys sometimes were allowed to run out. They simply left the hillside denuded of the bulk of the fine soil. So when he got there, he essentially had an eroded, slightly sloping hillside that had been so sprayed with poison in order, herbicides to some extent, the pesticides in particular, so that they could raise the thousands of turkeys on this ranch in the cramped conditions where you usually find them. That is, in a house and then in a closed yard above the ground for sunshine on one side of the house, or house, turkey house. He planted vegetables the first year. Essentially the cabbage family. He had a remarkable crop the first year. They all died. Got absolutely nothing. The land was so full of pesticides, herbicides, that they simply didn't grow. He had a nice way of putting it. I'm not sure that I have all the notes. I remember Denise in this term. Let me just check to see. No, I have lots of notes. But he said when a land is healthy, the plant absorbs from the land and produces the vegetables and the fruits. It's able to take from the soil because the soil has everything that is needed for its own health. And so the plant can use what is there. But when the soil is deficient, he put it in very interesting terms. He said the soil absorbs the plant. And that's what it did. The soil absorbed all that he planted that first year. It wasn't fit to eat. And the soil needed things, the microbes in the soil, breaking it down. Now, people haven't always thought how things work. But in the soil are various bacteria, microbes, viruses too. They break down the little particles of rock. They excrete acid, and it breaks it down so the minerals in the rocks are available. Actually, what they're doing, you'll pardon the illusion, they're really urinating. That's their body function. And the acidity from that is what is essential to the breakdown of the rock. Now, the tragedy on this farm is that the bulk of the rocks were large enough, small by comparison, but they were large enough that it would take a long time to break them down. So he's had to go to areas where fine mineralized rock is available and crush it and actually carry it up in the pickup truck in order that there can be the proper mineral resource on the hillside that was there and has since been washed away because the turkeys sometimes, when they were let out, ate up all the weeds, scratched the surface, but then the water came, and what you have, of course, is a wash. Now, he has an unusual approach. Not only did he challenge himself, you might want to think of this in terms of Mr. Armstrong's The Seven Laws of Success. He not only challenged himself to take a land that was illogical to use, but he challenged himself to build that land up so that it could be used. And he has done it in an unusual way. As he says, if I uprooted all the weeds, then I would be confronted with the fact that there would be nothing essentially to hold the soil when it rains. So he really has two kinds of crops. Vegetables that he sells from the fruit tree, and wheat. Now, a weed is a plant out of place. So, in this sense, we'll still call them weeds, even though in this case they are in place. They're necessary. What he has done is to encourage the growth of wheat wherever he does not have to have vegetation for market purposes. And he has Mexican-Americans. He employs himself and his wife. They have, I think, two children. And he employs four or five Mexican-Americans. Somebody asked him, why do you use them? And he gave the same answer, interestingly, the church members have. He says, because they do what I ask them. And it's just a marvelous statement to make. That doesn't mean these farmers know the truth about organic growing. They would do what you ask them if it were right or wrong in terms of farming. So I think that is something remarkable. Teach them, they will learn more. But I think that is one of the highest things one can say of any people. They will do what they are paid to do. They do what you ask them. And they cut down the vegetation when it gets so high. So what he does is, of course, plant vegetables close together in what is called the old French intensive method that I have addressed before. Not so old, but it's known for some time, which prevents the weeds as such from dominating. and he may have to cut a few weeds around certain areas or uproot them in a few cases right around the plant, or but those have to be done by hand. But otherwise, they simply keep them at a level where they are, in fact, a benefit to the soil by holding it, cut them off, but not uproot them, and that creates a certain ultimate humus. The plant provides an opportunity, of course, for greater microbial activity than if it was simply a hot, rocky hillside. He has learned that every kind of land has to be seen in its own right. There are some who criticize his method, and I would agree. I would not use that method on a rich soil. The next farm that we attended was that. So this man has to build it up to show what can be done, what are the techniques. And so he has learned to work with the weeds as a protection for the maintenance of the soil, and keep them as competitors of his vegetables under control. Now he worked hard. When he departed, he didn't just amble off, he loped off. That's the best way to describe it. A horse lope. It isn't a fast run, and it isn't a walk. He really moves around. He understands what it takes to be a success. We visited another ranch owned by Mr. and Mrs. Adamson. This is a strawberry farm. 50,000 plants. They bought the land in 1973. Mr. Adamson had some kind of stroke in 74, and she's had to run it ever since. Most people would have given up. After all, she has a job with the San Francisco Chronicle. Why shouldn't she do this? She explained it on one occasion. We were there. Because I work 5 days a week with people. I like people. She said, you know, it's nice to get out here sometimes away from people and with nature as God created it. It offers her a change of pace. That farmland is utterly the opposite. It is adobe soil, essentially old slate bed. It is so rich, they do not put anything on it. It would be a mistake to. It's perfect as it is. The soil is absolutely perfect for its job. They allow it to rest, not on the pattern of the sabbatical year, which I will go into, but they allow it to rest certainly adequately. They see that the weeds are kept down. There's no problem of erosion. You don't have to do with weeds what the farmer, Bob Kennard, had to do. And they rotate crops. They don't come back with the strawberries until 3 years have elapsed. I think we should learn a little something about this, because people in England who have studied this have recognized that, in a sense, crop rotation means that you don't come back until 3 years have elapsed from. In other words, if you did it in year one, and you do it in year four. If you did it in year two, you do it in year five. And that makes me think of the fact that probably, though it isn't said in the Bible, there was a reason that God, beside the financial need, built a pattern of year three and six, as years of tithing, in that cycle of seven, you know, when you have the third year, the year of the tithing for the poor, the needy, the widows, not to forget the Levites, who had need. The sixth year, the seventh year was a sabbatical rest of the land. Seven of those, and you had 50. In a sense, this implies that there is a connection between the financial implications in the Bible and what can be learned from experience, even about rich soil. It's worth considering how many implications, as distinct from direct spiritual communication, we may derive from Scripture in this connection. There are 50,000 strawberry plants. Bob Pinard and the group do all their work by hand as much as possible and only use cultivating or the initial plowing method or disking, whatever is essential for the crop, as little as possible. They generally do it only once in 7 years or so that they turn the soil over. Otherwise, they simply have to work it shallow. They've learned these things. In the same way, the Adamsons do a lot of hand labor. Strawberries of this nature are marketed in the countryside up there near the great metropolitan area, the Bay region. They are marketed at a very good price, but they guarantee that it is grown right, no pesticides, no herbicides, nothing but the finest soil, and every berry is edible. There is nothing with a defect. They guarantee it because everyone is hand-picked. And now there are different methods of irrigation. They use the spray method, where Bob Pinard's farm is. But in this organic strawberry farm, they don't do what is commonly done in Southern California, where you put plastic on the ground, and then you have to use herbicides to combat the molds and other diseases that love the warmth under the plastic on the ground. Now, the plastic is used because they also spray or in some way irrigate, it will vary, often above the ground, and the particles of sand or dirt would get on the strawberries. But the Adamsons have adopted a method that Bob Pinard does not like to use at his farm, and that is what we call drip irrigation. I can understand both premises. It depends on the product. In this case, by drip irrigation, nothing gets on the strawberries because they're not irrigating it. And, of course, if it rains, that can damage the crop, so that's irrelevant anyway. You wouldn't pick them for that purpose. But by irrigating them with a drip method, the berries are absolutely clean and free of soil particles. And it is quite remarkable what this family is able to do with this land. And they can command quite a price because they have something to offer in quality and in character where you don't have to throw away food like you often do when you get these plastic boxes of vegetables like that or fruit. Anyway, it was interesting to see the reality and how people work and apply principles in different ways depending on circumstances. And you, of course, need to think that through living here in Southern California. Any of you who may have home gardens, there are different principles to apply to the soil you have or which you have, because some of you may have something better or worse depending on circumstances. Anyway, the number of lectures were quite interesting. There was a remarkable presentation on fruits that my wife attended, and Mr. Don Schroeder, I think, attended that one, and I attended the one on new vegetable crops. So it is surprising what is being done today. There is such a thing as heirloom seed. I have addressed this question before. I think it's interesting to take note. There is a nursery devoted to what is called antique apples, and they also have other crops. Today, in 45 years since my formal studies in agriculture in the Santa Rosa High School, as distinct from junior college, in these 45 years, we have reduced ourselves to certain kinds of fruits. And I suppose most of you, if you were to name the fruits on the market, could name on two hands all the varieties that you could imagine that you had bought of apples. When I was studying agriculture, we could name 120 and more varieties. Many of these are quite remarkable. But they depend on care, specifically for the soil and purpose. It was unusual to see some of these now being reintroduced because more and more in California there is a growing demand and elsewhere a growing awareness. It's on a small scale, probably the same scale that the Church of God is in Christianity. This is the same scale in agriculture, though maybe we're not even that big. About 1% of crops grown in this state conform to the legal definition of organically grown, which was also discussed. That's in accordance with the California Health and Safety Code, whom I call certified organic farms, organizations, or some groups like that. Must be subject every year to review and examination. But to see and to have these things brought there and to realize that the world is full of remarkable food designed for different purposes, long since forgotten, or only recently forgotten, that have a significant special purpose. And that much of this, of course, is psychological as well as nutritional. It has to do with beauty. It has to do with surviving through the winter season. But generally the crops that are marketed have to be designed for shipping, and the shipping is green and will still ripen satisfactorily. It must have a certain look. One of the curses today in our marketplace is that when looks are not important, we've made it important. And when looks are important, we have made it unimportant. Well, that's a paradox, but it's the way the human mind thinks. There are blemishes that can be on apples just by nature. An apple is close to a branch and it rubs and it is blemished. But that doesn't hurt the apple, but it hurts the sale price. So the middleman, of course, docks the farmer. That's one of the big problems. Many things are not at all what they should be because we've used techniques, especially in fruits, significantly in vegetables, to have a certain appearance. And we judge by appearance, not by flavor, and not by quality, not by survivability through winter season. But the opposite happens with eggs, for instance. Eggs that should vary with the season. More yellow in summer, greener out here in winter and spring. We don't want those. They're more beautiful, but we don't want them. People are led to believe that if an egg looks too yellow, it is somehow diseased. Now, this arose, of course, from a commercial need. People would go into restaurants who didn't know anything about the farm, earlier part of the century. And they said, well, how come these eggs are yellow instead of orange for the yolk? I don't want them. I want orange eggs. But you can't have orange eggs all the time. And so in order to cater to people who were ignorant of the nature, the change in the seasons, because when chickens eat grass, the eggs get more orange in terms of the yolk. Well, the restaurants, the middlemen, then said, we insist that the birds have the same amount of green feed throughout the year so the eggs do not vary. And now they are limited, in other words, essentially, to the kind of input from alfalfa and other greens in their mashes so that eggs have this generally pale look throughout the year. But it's interesting to see in one area, because of ignorance, we don't profit by what would be available. And in the other area, we throw out good food, or we at least throw out food because it has blemishes or it might not be able to be picked early and ripened. Many fruits should be picked when they are ripe, and hence not shipped great distances. So that's all part of the problem. And so, by the way, in this the television program, I think it is interesting to see that you can't be a farmer without being a businessman. You can't be a farmer without knowing the middleman's and the retailer's problem. I think we ought to recognize that getting a job is far bigger than merely what most people think of in terms of the job. The job that is ultimately most satisfying is one that enables you to learn whatever it is you're learning, agriculture or otherwise, but enables you to learn business management, enables you to learn how to advertise and communicate, something Mr. Armstrong learned many, many years ago, enables you to decide, make decisions. One of the issues in the presidential election this year, decision making. Because you have to know what to do. They're learning that it pays to store and not merely to suddenly ship goods that can be kept in order that you don't all market at the same time when the price is lower, because it is essentially a free market. Anyway, I attended one lecture on birds, fowl. My wife did not. She didn't grow up on a chicken ranch, and I did. And horror of horrors, I will tell you what's happening. I thought there were bad enough problems when I left it 40 and more years ago. But now new techniques are coming. They're able to cross, for instance, certain turkeys so that the genetic background leads to chicks that have unusually meaty breasts, wonderful for the marketplace, wonderful for the pocketbook, except that now turkeys are being sold on the market as lost leaders, that is, seducers to get you into the shop, and you buy that, and then you buy the other higher-priced goods. So that, in fact, the turkey farmer is having it rough anyway, despite this. But one man posed a question. He said, "Now, I have thus and such a breed of turkey, and after so many months, about 18 weeks, they tend to die at significant rates, and often they seem to be physically unable to get about and to stand up as they should." And the woman who was representing the state of California immediately knew what the answer was. Well, she said, "Those birds were never meant to be kept to maturity. They are bred up so that they simply won't stand up." As she said, after they get about 18 weeks old, they walk around, this is her expression, like old ladies. Well, old men too. But she was, after all, was speaking as a woman. They're not used for breeding again. They're crossbred. Birds are raised today that have to have certain high-powered nutrition in order to grow normally. They're designed for that. And if they don't have it, they're stunted, their runts will die. I think it is a horrid situation to realize that we are already genetically creating creatures that cannot survive to maturity without some serious defect bodily. In the structure, it makes me wonder from time to time what Josephus would have said if this is what the Gentiles had been doing in that day. He's a remarkable man for showing what the Jews, who were keeping as close to the law as they could, did not do. The one thing he said they didn't do was had poisons around their homes. Now, we don't know how the Romans were using them, or the Roman world, the Greeks and others, but certainly that's one of the things we have today. I don't want to go any further in these areas, but it was, we want to keep up with it. Partly we have an agricultural program in which we are quite interested in the development of sustainable agriculture at different altitudes, as you know, in the country of Nepal, under the general direction there of General Aditya Rana, a very delightful person, a friend of Mr. Armstrong, a friend of this work. a dedicated Hindu, but nevertheless he sees in us something he sees nowhere else in the Christian world. Even though he's been warned by a Hindu, that we are a greater threat than any other form of Christianity to Hinduism. He sent someone over here to check us out, and he said that's what he thought. We really were. Because we do what we say. And of course, if you do what you say, you're a threat to anything that doesn't do what it says. And that's exactly the problem all through the world of religion. But he's not concerned about that because he understands that we don't intend to be a threat. But it was interesting how it was understood. Anyway, we do want to keep up on it. There's always something unusual, and you meet people you wouldn't have thought of before. That we should get some information that we can send to General Rana, might even be able to make available to our, brethren in some of the more rural areas where the church dwells. One of the peculiar things, of course, is among people in this field, I guess it's like among the prophets. There were some who had, like Samuel and Samson, long hair for certain reasons. Samson was of the tribe of Dan. But the man who was responsible for one of these farms was a typical long-haired person. Something that is unbecoming, but he doesn't know that as a man. And, of course, that was a symbol that you were under some kind of special authority. In the Old Testament, the Nazarite vow, it's not what he has, but his hair is like it. But yet he's a remarkable person. You meet all sorts. The clean-cut, clean-shaven, more traditional type. But this area gathers people who dare to think, whether dare to think as conservatives or dare to think as liberals. And you have to, in a sense, recognize that not everybody sees everything equally. And sometimes people in a field like this see things despite having come at it totally apart from the Bible. Now, I'd like to point up some interesting things in this connection that are in the Bible that might be lost. It seems an appropriate time to renew our understanding of some things that are written in Scripture about this pattern that I have addressed. You know, we have a farm, have had in the Big Sandy area. First of all, I will start out with a few comments. People sometimes ask, what is the church's policy with respect to how we should care for land? Let me state what it is that the church knows and does not know. I asked a very responsible, academically gifted Jewish conservative rabbi, Dr. David Winston, who was did one of the commentaries in the Anchor Bible series, what it is that the Jews know about how to care for the land, especially with respect to the matters of pruning. For instance, grapes. That was the initial question. And he said one of the great tragedies that the Jews have experienced is the fact that what is not a matter of direct written revelation in this connection is essentially lost, because there's been no continuity in some forms of agriculture, because the Jews never regularly lived in a situation where they were, in that sense, expected to know how to take care of certain crops in the manner of pruning. And let's say pruning is an art. Haircutting is an art. It's rather obvious when you see what happens sometimes when mothers try to do it on their little children. Then it becomes modern art. But that's one way to learn. Modern artists have nothing to learn, it appears. They don't change their mind generally, which is sad, instead of improving. But there are areas like this that you simply have to learn to experiment with. Now, to experiment, it's important to take note